We're very excited to have the speakers that we have for this special Amazing Health Summit. And this morning, Dr. Neil Nedley will be presenting. Now, for those of you who might not know who Dr. Nedley is, he's the author of multiple books. He is also the president of Wemore Institute, about a half an hour up the road. He's been there for almost 15 years. And we're just delighted that he's willing to share with us some wonderful expertise focusing on emotional health, well-being, depression recovery. So we're just very excited to have him share with us this morning. Thank you, Dr. Nedley.
Thank you. It's good to be with you this morning. And we're going to be talking about a vital topic on emotional health of children and adolescents. This is something in over the last decade that has been rapidly being more challenging. And we'll talk about the reasons for those challenges. There's a story of a drowning person going down a river with two men seeing this person, Bob, and they go into this swift river to rescue the drowning victim, take him to shore, do artificial respiration, get him revived, and then there's another victim going down the river. This happens three different times, and these two men are completely exhausted, and now there's five coming down the river, and one of the men gets up and actually does not go back into the river, but goes back upstream, and the other man is saying, "What are you doing? How are we going to save these people?" And he says, "Someone needs to go up there and tell those people not to get close to the river upstream." That is what we call primary prevention. And if we're going to be saving adult problems and preventing adult problems, we really have to get at it early in childhood in order to save a lot of the issues that we're going to be talking about here today. So emotional health and emotional intelligence is essentially knowing and understanding your emotions and the emotions of others and responding to those in a healthy way. And studies have shown that this contributes more to successful and enjoyable living than being a highly intelligent person or someone with high IQ. Since emotional intelligence is learned rather than inherited, it can be improved upon. And we have actually demonstrated this and documented in the scientific literature. Emotional intelligence is not something you're born with. It's something that you learn and develop and can significantly improve. There are five major components of emotional intelligence. One is knowing our emotions. That means to be able to not only identify what you're feeling, but why you're feeling that way. And if the why you're feeling that way is because someone just cut you off in traffic, you're not understanding your emotions. Because although that might have precipitated your thoughts, it's actually your thoughts about being cut off in traffic that initiate your emotions. And so this sometimes takes some time for people to really understand and know their own emotions. We call this self-awareness. The second aspect of emotional intelligence is managing your emotions. People with low emotional intelligence are simply managed by their emotions, moment by moment. Day by day, they're being managed by their emotions. People with high emotional intelligence still have powerful emotions. The difference is they're managing those emotions. And this is critically important because Dr. Baumeister from Stanford, who's now the most quoted researcher in all the world, tells us the pathway to the psychological good life. This is what everyone is searching for. Who doesn't want to live the good life? But how to get to the good life is to have comprehensive self-control. And you can't have comprehensive self-control unless you are able to manage your emotions. And the good news is, you're going to find out, this can start to occur in children. If we teach children correctly, they can actually develop self-control even at age 6 and even more so at age 11. The third aspect of emotional intelligence is recognizing your emotions in others. Now, this is important because emotional intelligence is not just about self. It's actually more about others. And when we can recognize emotions in others, then we can begin to empathize more. And empathy is a crucial aspect of emotional intelligence. Then managing our relationships. You might get an idea now why emotional intelligence is so much connected to enjoyable living, because that enjoyable living has a lot to do with our relationships and having healthy relationships and managing those relationships. A key aspect of what we call social intelligence, a component of emotional intelligence. And then the last component is a word that comes from emotion. In the word emotion is a word motion. If our emotions are based on true and accurate thoughts, it can powerfully motivate us to achieve our goals. And so you can also understand why an individual who might have a very high IQ, be very intelligent, maybe have some good genetic brain material, might not do well in school because they don't have the motivation. And they might not do well in the workplace. And they might not do well even in family relationships because they don't have emotional intelligence. Studies show very clearly it's far better to have an average IQ and a high EQ. EQ is the emotional quotient, the way of measuring emotional intelligence, because those people will actually be your 4.0 students, even though they might not have the greatest brain, because they have that motivational component. And if they're motivated that way, they're going to be motivated in other healthy ways as well, at least quite likely. Children with better self-control. As you can see, this was published by Psychological Science not long ago. But it turns out if children at age 6 have more self-control, they're actually more popular with other children. A lot of times people think, hey, those with comprehensive self-control aren't going to be well-liked. That's not what the studies show. They're actually greater liked by a broader group of people. Then if you're 6 years old and you have self-control, it will accurately predict what your SAT scores are at age 16 or 17. So this is why childhood development is very important in learning these things, in managing your emotions, because we think, well, maybe if they go to a good school at age 14 or 15 or 16, they'll do better on SAT. Yes, that can help some. But actually, it's the self-control aspect, managing the emotions, that's far more critical of getting high on those SAT or ACT scores. Displaying self-control by age 11 has been shown to be highly correlated with successful employment throughout participants' lives. So you will have better employment, and you will also have more raises along the way. In fact, people with low self-control experience 3 times as many months of being unemployed over 22 years when compared with those with high self-control. Threefold difference is great. And we have a problem with unemployment and underemployment. And that problem actually is very much connected to the emotional intelligence of how that was developed even when you were a child. So not only does emotional intelligence help us in our employment and our family relationships and our social aspect and even being able to manage our own emotions, but it's been shown to help prevent or treat a number of diseases that are increasing among our pre-K through 12 age groups throughout America. It's been shown to effectively prevent or treat depression. Phobias are going up significantly in our younger age population. Social phobias are at an all-time high. We'll talk about some of the reasons for that, but many of our children don't like to be around other human beings and have that full social interaction. They're actually very anxious about that. Obsessive compulsive disorder is also on the rise, as is post-traumatic stress disorder. And then eating disorders, which are becoming more common, such as anorexia and bulimia. And addictions, which are now at an all-time high. In fact, the 12-step program showed this. Uncle Bob's 12-step program often teaches you that your first year of sobriety, you have to be patient, is going to be the worst year of your life. Why will he tell you it's the worst year of your life? Because you're going to get into stinking thinking. Before, you just numbed your thinking. But now you don't have anything to numb your thinking, and you're going to get into stinking thinking, and so be patient. Life will get better after year one. Studies show if we put those same alcoholics that are going to a 12-step program and also add a program to enhance their emotional intelligence, they will have the first year of sobriety be the best year of their life ever to that point, and life will continue to improve thereafter because they are able to themselves get rid of the stinking thinking as a result of their improved emotional intelligence. And many times these addictions are beginning early in life. And so it's very important to enhance the emotional intelligence of our children. Studies show if we have higher emotional intelligence, violence against family and others are far greater reduced. And this is one of the reasons why I got more involved in this topic. We'll talk about this. But that story I told you about the drowning was actually told by a chief judge in a district that was dealing with all of the adverse effects of emotional intelligence in the courtroom and having to sentence people to long sentences and all of these things. And he came to the conclusion, along with other judges, we need to go upstream. We need to try to prevent these things before they're ever happening. And that's how I got involved in working with that system. Relationship breakups, which are often very traumatic on individuals. In fact, studies show that young people who are thinking of suicidal thoughts and maybe even have committed suicide, it's often due to a relationship breakup, and that has a lot to do with lack of emotional intelligence. Increased emotional intelligence not only helps diseased minds, but it helps even normal people think clearer, communicate more effectively. It fosters unity in group settings. It reduces polarizing statements, and it promotes a happier life. But notice, all of this is accomplished without compromise or sacrificing the truth. A lot of times people think the only way we can get along is to get to the lowest common denominator and put truth aside. The emotional intelligence experts realize that's not true. The only way you can have unity when stress is coming into the situation is if that unity is based on bedrock truth. So people with high emotional intelligence are very interested. What is accurate? What is true? What is helpful? And how can I reframe my thoughts to be in those categories? And this is something we can actually teach, as you will find out, as low as kindergarten and grade one. Let's take a look at the facts about mental disorders in the United States. The four most common in children are ADHD, that's attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, anxiety, behavior problems, and depression. Those four are commonly diagnosed in children today. Estimates for ever having a diagnosis among children age 3 through 17 in the 2016 to 2019 years, ADHD was number one, with almost 10% of our children already having a diagnosis by a health professional of ADHD. That's 6 million children. Very close to that, however, is anxiety. 5.8 million children having anxiety or an anxiety disorder. Behavioral problems are almost 9%, over 5.5 million. And then depression is the least common in the age 3 to 17-year-old age group, but still number 4 at 4.4%. That's 2.7 million children, as we're talking here today, having depression. Now, that was back in 2016 to 2019. Do you think it's lower than that today, or is it higher than that today? It actually is higher, and we will discuss some of the reasons for that. As you can see, it's increasing over time. Ever having been diagnosed with either anxiety or depression among children aged 6 to 17 increased from 5.4% in 2003 to 8% in 2007, and then to 8.4% in 2011 and 2012. And you will see after that time period, it goes up exponentially. And so it was already going up prior to that by over 50% in that decade, 2003 to 2012. What about age 12 to 17? This is the 2018-2019 reporting year. Now, why am I using these statistics in 2023? Because the CDC just published these statistics last year and this year. So this is the latest CDC data, and this is one that I think everyone can kind of agree upon on what was the case back then in 2018 and 2019. So let's see what they say about that 1 year. This is 12 to 17-year-olds. 15% had already a diagnosis of major clinical depression. 36.7% had persistent feelings of sadness or hopelessness. Now, many of those hadn't been diagnosed yet with depression, but we know that is a primary symptom of depression. So had they gone through the analysis, the depression rates would have been much higher. 4.1% had a substance use disorder, so they were already addicted to a substance. 1.6%, it was alcohol that they were addicted to, and this is before they're ever an adult. But notice it's double that. 3.2% had an illicit drug use disorder. And so this is very significant among our young people. Now, if that doesn't concern us, take a look at the rest of what the CDC is reporting here. 18.8% seriously considered attempting suicide in just that 1 year. That's almost one out of five of our 12 to 17-year-olds in this country. 15.7% went so far as to make a suicide plan to end their life. And 8.3% actually attempted suicide. Almost one out of 10 of our children attempting suicide, 12 to 17. Now, 2.5% of them, their attempt was so serious, they required hospitalization and medical treatment, et cetera, for the injuries they had done to themselves. So if we wonder whether this is a valid topic today, I think you've just gotten your answer by looking at this. We are in a serious crisis in regards to our children and our adolescents and their mental health. Mental behavioral and developmental disorders actually begin in early childhood. 1 in 6 U.S. children aged 2 to 8 had a diagnosed mental behavioral or developmental disorder. And a diagnosis of ADHD, anxiety, and depression become more common with increased age. Let's take a look at that statistic now. So let's just look at the depression side of things in this bar graph. You can see depression is almost unheard of in children under the age of 5. They really, at that point, don't have the ability to reflect upon themselves enough to get depressed when they're 5 and under. But notice at age 6, it dramatically increases. So this is 6 to 11-year-olds, and by the time you get to 12 to 17-year-olds, it's exponentially risen to significant high rates of depression. Anxiety, you can have anxiety when you're under 5. Notice anxiety is much more common in 5 and under, but it goes up even more at age 6 to 11, and then it goes up dramatically once again at age 12 to 17. Behavioral problems are the most common mental issue with 5 and under, and it becomes even more common when you're 6 to 11, but then it tends to settle down by age 12 to 17. But notice those rates of depression and anxiety skyrocketing as our children age. So the question is, when did mental illness begin to skyrocket? We notice from those periods up to 2012, it's rising like 50% over that decade, but that's not quite skyrocketing. When did it go exponential? It started to go exponential in 2012. What happened in 2012 and beyond? That's when one half of Americans owned a smartphone. Every country since, America was the first one to have their country have half of the people own a smartphone by 2012. In every subsequent country, I was in Kenya when half of the Kenyans now had a smartphone, rates of depression and anxiety had skyrocketed. And so what is it about this smartphone that is causing issues? And actually, those issues don't seem to be settling down. They're actually been worse over time. And then we see another skyrocketing occurring from 2020 onward. There are some statistics being released. The CDC hasn't put it all together yet, but there's individual studies where you can see a remarkable increase after 2020. We know there was the pandemic in 2020, and this was the one the media talked about. But there was another pandemic that did not get talked about very much. And Gallup showed that this pandemic had more financial consequences and more health consequences than the actual COVID pandemic. What was the pandemic that was not being talked about? The pandemic of skyrocketing mental illness. So let's take a look. Why was that associated? Well, we had to socially distance. You know, the biggest punishment you can give a prisoner is what? Solitary confinement. So we had to socially distance, we had to be confined. And then on top of that, if we wanted to get educated, we had to get educated how? By screens and online. Here is the issue in regards to the smartphone. And I must admit, I was not necessarily intuitive when this came out. When smartphones came out, I already knew the problems with entertainment television. Rapid scene of reference in movies and entertainment television cause a frontal lobe suppression within 90 seconds to 3 minutes when you're watching entertainment television. But I thought, this is interactive. This is interactive, and so the frontal lobe should be able to be involved, and we probably will be okay with this, although studies had not been done on it. But what the information shows us is when students go to their Zoom classroom and they start looking at their Zoom teacher, within 3 minutes, they're no longer engaged in the class. Why are they no longer engaged? Because if they're interested in like BMWs, the engineers, software engineers know this, and pretty soon there's a BMW floating across that screen that says a new BMW is available at your local dealer. Oh, well, this won't hurt much, and so I'll click on a BMW. Seems harmless enough, but then when you get into that BMW, you now see that there's a YouTube video of that BMW doing something, and pretty soon you're into that. But then, before you have a chance to even finish that YouTube video, a friend of yours texts you, then you get an email notification, and now you get a news notification on top of that, and these devices, the way they're normally used, drive us to distraction. Why is that a problem? Because the frontal lobe is the area where we need focused attention. It's the anterior cingulate gyrus of the frontal lobe. And if we can't pay attention for long periods of time, we will not be able to manage our emotions, because that area of the brain is also the area that we need to manage distressing emotions. And so our educators were concerned because they weren't in a real classroom and they were doing these things online and they didn't even know if they were paying attention. They finally got to the place where they could actually see if they were in front of the screen or not, but it didn't tell you what they were looking at on that screen. And we need that anterior cingulate gyrus to develop healthfully in children in order for them to develop a high degree of emotional intelligence. So this was a study of over 1 million young people, major longitudinal study by Gene Twenge at University of San Diego. Teens who spend large amounts of time glued to phone and computer screens are markedly, what? Less happy than those who preferred real-world activities and interactions. We think our children are doing well on their screens. You know, they don't bother us so much. Let them there on their screens, they might be learning something. But in reality, it is destroying their emotional health to a large degree. Social media, texting, video chatting, and multi-platform video games, all associated with decrease in happiness. Youth who invested more time in what type of activities? Non-screen activities, such as playing sports, reading newspapers, or healthy books, engaging in face-to-face social interactions, were significantly happier children. Life satisfaction, self-worth, and happiness of young people in the U.S. plummeted after what? 2012, the year when the proportion of Americans owning a smartphone rose by over 50%. And so we exponentially made this problem worse by putting our children indoors and putting them in front of screens where they could easily get distracted. And measuring happiness, the happiness teenagers are those who use digital media less than what? 1 hour per day of screen time. And if you do more than 1 hour a day, your levels of unhappiness will rise steadily. And also your anterior cingulate gyrus is going to shrink. When your brain doesn't need focused attention, this anterior cingulate gyrus, due to neuroplasticity, says I'm not being used for focus attention, and it starts pruning it away. We can see it on MRIs, where the anterior cingulate gyrus is actually shrinking down. That means it's going to be a process to build it back up again. Fortunately, with neuroplasticity, we can do that, and we'll talk a little bit about this. Well, what about if they're just interacting? Since they couldn't interact face-to-face, why don't we just have them interact by social media? Studies show social media makes us antisocial. We are attached to social media as a means of connection, but soon virtually everyone ends up comparing far more than they connect. And there are those three antisocial children all together connecting via social media. We compare via a false world that looks true, but it actually isn't. Time spent with media devices cannot be regained. This is another concern. Media devices waste a lot of time, sometimes hours each day. In fact, the typical young person today is on their media devices at least 3 hours a day, and some of them as high as 8 and 10 hours a day. They keep us from doing healthy activities, spending time with our families, and engaging in productive work. One of the things I've also noticed is if you're on media devices, you are not outside. Those screens don't work very well out in the sun. I don't know if you've noticed that or not. And so it pulls you inside, and one of the things our children need for adequate development is not only fresh air, but they need the infrared light that comes from the sun to help their brains develop more. Our children should be spending far more time outdoors and certainly less time indoors. By the way, the typical person today, after COVID, less than 9% of their time is ever outdoors. And this is a problem also for adults. Children learn more from devices than they do from their parents these days. In fact, studies show by the time an 18-year-old comes about, they will have learned much more from their device than they ever learned from their parent. And of course, you can understand why. They might ask, what is the population of Sacramento? The parent's not sure about it. They can ask Siri, and immediately they can get an answer. And, you know, it seems like a pretty good answer, and so Siri seems pretty smart. Well, the problem is the 10 technology companies that control all of this media and flow of information have a lot of things that are not so smart that they put up there and that are actually distorted. And so when our kids start asking important questions, they're not going to get the right answers from these 10 technology companies, but they think they will because this device knew the population of Sacramento. So the other issue is parents, when they're home, they're often connected to their devices. And when parents are connected to their devices, what do you think children are going to do? They're going to connect even more. I would really encourage parents in raising your children to minimize your device time. And when you do have to get on a device, find your answer and get off and spend time with your children. Go outdoors with them. Do some enjoyable things with them. But don't just vegetate indoors with both of you on devices. Allowing kids free access to smartphone gives them access also to the creeps of the world. And the creeps of the world are abundant on the internet. And they know how to attract our children and teach them all sorts of things that are not going to help their brain or their physical or mental health. Daniel Goleman says it's very important for everyone to have a digital Sabbath. Does it say once a week? Digital Sabbath every day. What does that mean? A digital Sabbath is a time when adults and kids are not having any devices around and not allowing themselves to be distracted by any devices. During that time, engage in focused learning or healthy activities. Well, what if our kids have been using devices too much? Dr. Victoria Dunkley, a child and adolescent psychiatrist, has seen the skyrocketing rates of mental illness. And she has stated she won't diagnose any of these mental illnesses in our children until they give up all screens and devices for 6 weeks. It's called a 6-week EFAST. What happens then? She says the vast majority, their symptoms normalize. They don't have an underlying mental health condition at all. It's just produced as a result of these devices. After that EFAST of 6 weeks, then you actually are intentional on removing phone applications that you can get stuck in so that they're not even available. Turn off push notifications, text notifications, email notifications, and then spend less than an hour a day on devices outside of work. And don't spend any time on any device an hour before going to bed, because it's going to decrease your melatonin output and your circadian rhythm. Another significant issue in our child's development today is adverse childhood experiences, which are also on the rise, in part due to the same issue as well as more addictions. The adverse childhood experiences center on abuse, either physical, emotional, or sexual. It may not be abuse, but it might be neglect, physical or emotional neglect. And if you're a parent spending a lot of time on devices, you are causing the emotional neglect of your children, which will show up in issues down the road. Household dysfunction, mental illness, divorce, substance use, violence against mother, incarceration of a relative or caregiver is also a significant developmental hit that many of our children go through. And in regards to being raised in a healthy two-parent household, from 0 to 18, less than 25% of our children have that opportunity today. 75% of children are not going to be raised by biological mom or dad from 0 to 18. There's a Harvard Mastery of Stress study that took a look at children and whether they would develop a significant disease by age 50. The biggest predictor that they found is if those children did not develop a good, healthy relationship with both mom and dad. If they didn't develop a good, healthy relationship with both mom and dad, 91% chance they had significant physical disease or significant mental disease by age 50. If they had a good relationship with one of them, it was a 50% chance, like a coin flip. But if they had a good relationship with both of them, 25%. In other words, 75% by age 50, very healthy, physically, mentally doing well. We shouldn't be surprised at this, because the fifth commandment says, honor thy father and thy mother, that thy what? That thy days may be long upon the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee. And we have underemphasized, especially the relationship with fathers. It's good to have a relationship with mother, but it's also good to have a relationship with loving, authoritative fathers. Study by Dr. Lamb showed if you have a loving, authoritative father in your life, you have a higher chance of being an A student. You will develop a higher IQ. You'll be a better problem solver. You're more likely to enjoy school and be engaged. You will have higher economic and educational achievement as an adult. You'll be better able to handle strange situations. You'll be more resilient in handling stress and more curious in exploring. In other words, your frontal lobe will be developed, more creativity. You'll have less depression and significantly improved life satisfaction. In addition, you will be able to conform to rules and be fine with those rules if you have a loving, available father. Long-term successful marriages and the children will be the norm if they are raised in an environment with a loving, authoritative father. They'll have more long-term close friends. They'll have higher empathy for others, higher moral values. Notice this, 80% less likely to ever go to jail. The differentiator is having that loving, authoritative father. 75% less likely to become unwed parents when you have this in the household. And so the attack that we are seeing nationwide on the family is actually causing a lot of these issues in our childhood and emotional health. And of course, you'll have better physical health as well as emotional health. There are other behaviors that improve emotional intelligence and been well proven to do this in children. One is getting on a fitness program. That improves neurotransmitter receptors and release. It improves your cognition, it improves your mood, improves your memory, which is also very important for academic excellence as you go forward. And it's also important in regards to the diet that we are eating. This study was a largest study of its kind in over 4,000 kids aged 3, 4, 7, and 8.5 year olds, and they controlled it for known factors that can affect IQ, and they found diet alone had a vital role in regards to our children's ability to learn, retain, and apply knowledge. 20% with the highest processed diet, in other words, the most junk food, higher in fats and sugar, 5-point lower IQ compared to the 20% with the healthiest diet. And if you would look at the top 1 percentile, which would be more plant-based, it ended up being over a 10-point difference. That's well over a standard deviation improvement in IQ just as a result of the association with diet. Well, our emotions are largely controlled not only by our habits and what we are doing, like being outdoors and having real life activities, but also very much involved in our beliefs, our evaluation of events, the way we think about problems, and our silent self-talk. This is where we get into the thoughts and feelings. And this is very important, I think, to discuss in children. Your feelings result from the messages you give yourself. Your thoughts have much more to do with how you are feeling than what is actually happening in your life. This has been well proven in the psychological standpoint. We think it's just the happenings in life that cause these feelings. No, it's our thoughts that have much more to do with how we are feeling. If you wonder if this is the case, remember Paul and Silas. When they were beaten with rods and they were put in prison and their feet were put up in stocks and they had all these bad things happen to them, they were crying uncontrollably and saying, "Why us, Lord?" Is that what they were doing? No, they had happy looks on their faces, singing praises to God. Why is that the case? Because their thoughts had much more to do with how they were feeling than what was actually happening in their life. That's how important the thoughts are. And they were thinking helpful thoughts, true and accurate thoughts. And what a difference this can make, even under adverse situations. So we teach our children how to recognize thinking errors. It's not just A to C thinking, the activating event going to the emotional consequence. This is what traditional psychotherapy has shown, which is no better than taking a placebo. Dr. Ellis calls A to C thinking, activating event to emotional consequence, is believing that we have little or no ability to influence our feelings and that events and situations directly cause our emotions and behavior. He says this is very crooked. What straightens it out is the B. The activating event is then followed by the B, which is our belief and our thought. And the big thing that we're trying to teach our children, is that belief accurate? Is it helpful? Because if it is, it will positively affect the C, no matter what the A is. So we don't disregard the A. We know that tends to bring about B's, but we want to look at rational and helpful beliefs versus irrational and very unhelpful beliefs. Well, over a year ago, the Pacific Judicial Council learned about what we were doing at Weimar University in our Emotional Intelligence Summit. Every year, Weimar University holds an Emotional Intelligence Summit. And by the way, all of you are invited to our next one. It always occurs on spring break, so that's March 16 to 19. Where we can take in the rest of the campus. And by the way, Pastor Doug will also be a speaker at that Emotional Intelligence Summit. And this person from this country and in this U.S. territory, there are several that were attending this every year and learning things about emotional intelligence. One of them that was learning told Chief Judge Francis Gatewood about what was happening on those emotional intelligence summits. This is a judge that was appointed by President Bush in the federal system and then reappointed, actually, I believe recently, by President Biden, so both sides. And she invited me, along with the head of the Pacific Judicial Council, another judge, to talk to educators, legislatures, the executive branch, and the judicial branches of government in Guam and the surrounding 10 islands. The Ninth Circuit, which is the federal court system over Arizona, California, Washington, Oregon, Nevada, and also Hawaii and Guam and those other U.S. territories, teamed up with them for this to occur. And so when I was out there speaking to all of these government officials, they then requested, it wasn't me asking for this at all, but they said, "Is it possible for you to develop a curriculum?" We're in charge of the public school systems here. And if we could teach emotional intelligence on a public school level, what a difference we think this could make. And so we would like to pilot this. And so they asked us to start actually at the younger grades and go all the way through K through 12. Well, since emotional intelligence is learned, it would seem reasonable that if we're learning math and science and social studies, that we ought to be able to learn emotional intelligence. At least that's what they were thinking as a result of the information that I gave them. So they said, what about teaching in pre-K through grade 12 as we would math or social studies? And of course, they wanted the program to be interesting, interactive, and engaging as well. Well, this was piloted in grades 2, 5, and 9 on 10 islands and Guam in the public school system. And the public school system felt comfortable because the judicial branch, legislative branch, and executive branch all came together and said, this is safe. We want you to teach this curriculum. And then they had to choose teachers that would be willing to teach a new curriculum. And so we just came back 2 months ago from the reporting conference of all of these teachers, grades 2, grades 5, grades 9, to show us the before and after differences. And it was pretty amazing listening to them. They said, never before have we taught a course where the students, when the bell rings and this class is over with, they're saying, teacher, this class is over already? We're having such fun. This is enjoyable. Teacher, what are we going to learn tomorrow about our brains? They said they never had had that, where they're asking ahead of time what they're going to learn. They mentioned the excitement of even the kids learning about healthy music that would affect their brain. They talked about when they first heard the healthy music, they would say, teacher, is that music? We've never heard music like that. Our music is not very healthy for us. And about 3 weeks into it, the teacher would quit playing the music at the beginning of class, and the teachers would hold her responsible and say, teacher, we like that new music. It's helping our nerves. It's helping us be more calm. Where is that music? We want to hear that music. And so they were learning things in a way where crafts were involved and activities. They didn't just learn the things. They had to go do the things that would actually help their brain. And then the parents would come back and say, what are you teaching my children? They're actually wanting to work. They're wanting to go home and wash dishes. They're actually far more appreciative. We've never heard them say thank you. And they're showing gratitude to us. And also they're able to manage their emotions more. One of the teachers who taught the curriculum said, I had never heard of EQ or emotional intelligence, but I was willing to learn about it. And I realized that my marriage that was currently going through a divorce was actually due to my own lack of emotional intelligence. So I not only taught this to my children, but I incorporated all these principles. And in 10 weeks, my marriage was saved and it was back. This course has saved my marriage. Another teacher who came from one of the most of the islands do have a religious aspect in regards to Roman Catholicism. But one of the teachers who was teaching fifth graders said, after this course, I realized what I was teaching my students was better than religion. And she says, let me explain. Our religion teaches us what we must do before we die so we go to heaven. But death seems a long ways away from these fifth graders. But what I was teaching them can actually help them have heaven on earth right now. And the legislatures were listening to this. The Supreme Court justice head, the Chief Justice was listening to this. The governor was there, was commenting. And even though in the public school curriculum, we weren't teaching the spiritual component, we were only teaching basically New Star in the public school system, what came up was the T. and God started being discussed, and they were high-fiving each other in regards to how the government was actually doing something healthy for our kids and helping them also to stay away from these substances. There were four units. Unit one was brain anatomy and physiology. We found out that second graders can learn what their frontal lobe does and what their amygdala does. The parents would come back and say, I did something and I lost my temper, and my student in second grade that is in your class says, I'm letting my amygdala rule my frontal lobe. What is that? And so the parents were also interested, and so they would go through outreach, and of course they'd be able to paste these things on the board. The head psychologist of Guam said, we've never seen a program that's so comprehensive. We've seen programs that might deal with anger, that might deal with substances, but this is overall brain health. And then unit two, we teach them comprehensive brain health, how to be able to increase their anterior cingulate gyrus through nutrition, lifestyle, physical activities, and even working with their hands in 3D, as well as expressing gratitude. Unit three, we teach them all about emotional intelligence, how to manage their emotions, manage their relationships. And unit four is one they also have fun with, recognizing and correcting the 10 categories of thinking errors that we all get into. Instead of calling them cognitive distortions, we call them thinking errors. And we want those thinking errors to be corrected into helpful thoughts. Well, this only lasted for a 10-week curriculum. At the beginning of the course, 20% of the students in the public school system thought it was important for them to prioritize the health of their brain. At the end of the course, 90% said it was important for them to prioritize the health of their brain, and they were already incorporating these principles. So in one quarter, can you deliver a pre-K to grade 12 curriculum for every year? That's what we were asked after December with the piloting conference. Not just grades 2, 5, and 9. Can this be every year where it's part of, you know, you take math every year, you take social studies every year. Shouldn't we take things like emotional health every year? And so our team, of course, we have a lot of team of educators also helping with this, are really working hard to be ready for August. But the public schools in the 10 Pacific Islands are now going to mandate the teaching of NuSTAR. That's nutrition, exercise, water, sunlight, temperance, fresh air, and adequate rest, and truthful, helpful thoughts. And I have little doubt that this will greatly improve the family violence, the substance use, and the many emotional and problematic issues. Ellen White told us, years ago, before Christ comes, we shall see medical missionary work broadening and deepening at every point of its progress because of the inflowing of hundreds and thousands of streams until the whole earth is covered as the waters cover the sea. She actually predicted medical missionary work would go around the globe in this way. And she says, the light God has given on health reform is for our salvation and the salvation of the world. Messages to Young People says, our thoughts, if we have bad thoughts, we will have bad feelings. And she says, our thoughts and feelings combined make up the moral character. I think it's time that we emphasize the thoughts and feelings of our pre-K children, of our elementary school children, and of our adolescent children, and start producing a big shift in the opposite direction over what's happened over the last couple of decades. God bless you.